semester for part one. Hope to see you all for part two. And we'll end today by finishing up our discussion of initial conditions. So talking about theory of inflation and the homogeneous limit. You stick around, you get to learn about particle production during inflation in the early universe and how those particles that are produced end up turning into galaxies in you and me. I think that's one of the most elegant and beautiful calculations in all of physics. It's really cool. So stick around. Okay, so let me talk about one last property of our standard cosmological model, Lambda CDM, so that we can discuss. For someone remote, could you mute your mic? Because it comes back to me and I get to hear myself. I don't like hearing my own voice. Okay, so let's talk about the initial conditions for Lambda CDM. So that we know what we need to solve. What are the problems that we're actually needing to solve? Or are they problems or whatever? So let's talk about the causal structure of FRW universes. If we want to talk about causal structure, it's more convenient to work with the conformal time. So if we write down the metric for a flat Robertson-Walker universe for the moment, let's forget about curvature. The conformal time tau is defined as the integral dt over a, so that we could introduce a overall conformal factor in front of this, which just looks like flat space. And for the moment, let's focus on radiation domination, just to pick on something. So we know early in the universe, it is believed to be radiation dominated, at least the time BBN happened and the universe is older than that, perhaps earlier. And during radiation domination, the scale factor in terms of conformal time is pretty simple, it's just tau. And if we set the scale factor today equals one, we can just put here the normalization factor is the conformal time today, whatever that happens to be. And there's no problem extending tau from zero to infinity. When tau goes to zero, that's what we call the Big Bang. And now we can draw pictures. So we can draw a space-time diagram of conformal time versus position. This is the present-day conformal time, and this is the Big Bang. So again, to reiterate, Big Bang is time, not a place. That's the time of the Big Bang, tau equals zero. We can trace light rays back in time from our present position until they hit the Big Bang, okay? Notice that they don't go on forever, so that implies that the total volume of the universe that we're able to access causally is finite, okay? It's only this piece in here. Conformal time is particularly nice because we could figure out what the radius of this sphere that we get to see is. It's just the conformal time today, right? Light travels on 45 degree lines because here we've got just flat space. It's conformal to flat space. So this is tau naught. That had a name, that was the particle horizon. The particle horizon is just the integral of dt over a from zero to t naught. That's just the definition of the conformal time. So that's just really tau naught, right? So if we go back in time, let's say that this is the time of last scattering. So this is when the CMB was formed. So when photons from the early universe stopped interacting with free electrons. So we have a photon over here coming from my left that travels from last scattering, and I observe it today. And then I have a photon over here on my right, and that photon travels from last scattering until today. And an observed property of the CMB is that the CMB is basically the same temperature everywhere. Okay? And all the calculations we've done so far assumed a homogeneous universe where everything is in equilibrium everywhere, right? Same temperature everywhere. But that state of affairs is kind of puzzling, because if we think about these two points and we ask about their particle horizons, you can see that they never overlapped. So these two points were totally out of causal contact, and yet they knew that they needed to be exactly the same temperature. We could look at all the properties, like the distribution of radiation and matter. You know, there were just as many protons and photons and electrons over here as there are over here, but there was no way of that being synchronized. Okay? And that implies that that information about the universe's homogeneity had to be imprinted as an initial condition. Okay? There's no way that that could have been established causally in lambda CDM. So that has a name that goes by the name of the horizon problem. I think the word problem is too strong. It's just a feature. It's the feature of our universe. Okay, we can draw some more pictures. So a particularly useful quantity to think about is the co-moving Hubble parameter. So that gets a letter, fancy H. And fancy H is defined as the conformal time derivative of the scale factor divided by the scale factor. So it's just like H, except for instead of the proper time, I use the conformal time here. Okay, so we can chain rule this. So that's dA dt, dt d tau over A. But dt d tau from this definition over here is just A. So this is really just dA dt, or in other words, the scale factor times the usual Hubble parameter. Okay. So A times H is interchangeable for fancy H. So we can also define the co-moving horizon. Co-moving horizon is just 1 over fancy H, or 1 over A times H. And the co-moving horizon is kind of a causality scale. So it allows us to determine the distance scales over which points can be correlated causally. So we can draw a picture to illustrate that. This, if we compute it, is just tau in radiation domination, right? DAD tau is 1, A is tau, so 1 over tau, 1 over 1 over tau, tau.
Why is tall? I mean, is tall every time only at present?
Tau is a variable, so it's the conformal time. Tau with a 0 is the present day conformal time. So the co-moving horizon is a time-dependent thing, just like H in general, the Hubble parameter is a time-dependent thing. Yeah. Same here.
I see.
Okay, and if we were to draw a picture of what the co-moving horizon does in radiation domination. Okay, it's just a straight line. So let's say I have an object of fixed co-moving size. So a perfect example of an object with fixed co-moving size would be one of the Fourier modes of the density fluctuations we talked about last time. Okay. But anyway, I have some object. It's got some co-moving size L. Okay, and this object just sits here and evolves in time. And so let's consider this object at a really early time, say here. Let me take better advantage of my colors. Okay, so if I have this object at this time, then I can imagine a gazillion tiny little robots that are sent off to assemble this object. And even if my robots could travel at the speed of light, you can see there is no point where I could causally reach the ends. Okay? Unless my robots were all synchronized to leave at the same time and reconstruct this object, there's no way that they could causally communicate and do that, right? So there's no causal way of setting up this structure, this object. The endpoints of the object, for example, are not at all in causal contact, right? If I wait till a later time, say up here, then no problem, right? I could have a gazillion little robots at this position, and they could travel out and they could reconstruct this object, but none of them would have to travel faster than the speed of light. They could all be synchronized and it would be possible to build this structure causally. Okay. Now, here's the rub. Because the co-moving horizon in a radiation-dominated, or it turns out in a matter-dominated universe, it's the same story. This thing is tau over 2. In matter domination, so it's really not significantly different story. The co-moving horizon is always increasing with time. Okay, and so that implies that there is always a time before which it is impossible to set up causally any object of fixed co-moving size. We give that a time a name, so we say it. If I was a better drawer, it would happen at the same time. But anyway, let's draw a slightly better picture. Okay, this time, when this object just crosses the co-moving horizon, we call that horizon crossing. Before that time, we say that this structure is super horizon. And after this time, we say it is sub horizon. And we can estimate that horizon crossing happens when the size of this object we're interested in is just equal to the co-moving horizon. Okay. So if we go far enough back in time, any structure of fixed co-moving size will become superhorizon. And if the initial conditions are really set down here, then that had to be set up in an acausal fashion. There's no way for a gazillion little robots to build that structure causally. So in our universe, there are lots and lots of structures of many different sizes. So this wouldn't necessarily be a problem if the only thing in the universe were objects of one fixed co-moving size, because then I could say, ah, well, the initial conditions just had to be set here, right? And then all of these structures could have been assembled causally. But in our universe, we observe structures on all sizes. So that argument is not really going to work out. So to consider that, let's make a plot. Arguably one of the most important plots in all of cosmology. Okay, it's a log plot of the wavelength of objects or perturbations or modes, whatever you want to call them, a fixed co-moving size as a function of conformal time. So we can draw the co-moving horizon, and it looks like a straight line. At matter domination, it also looks like a straight line with slightly different slope. Okay, so this could be matter or radiation. It doesn't really matter. It's the qualitatively the same picture. And then if I consider a mode of some fixed size, then you can see that over here, at some late time, you could have a lot of scales that are sub-horizon, but then if we go backwards in time, they will all eventually become super-horizon. And in our universe, we sort of populate the universe with all sorts of scales, right? And they all have different horizon crossing times, and there's going to be no unique time on which I can say the initial conditions happened here and everything was able to be arranged causally, right? Things are crossing the horizon at different times. They're always crossing the horizon. yeah, so. We observe modes on all scales, and there's no way to produce all of them causally. And that's just that, right? More mathy way of seeing this. We talked about these correlation functions last time. And so in real space, position x and a position x prime are correlated. And we understood this correlation by looking at a Fourier integral. So let's say that there was like a cutoff, like there were no fluctuations at k below a certain value, right? Then points would stop being correlated on distances longer than that certain value. And well, if that happened to be some finite distance, right, then we could have said, OK, well, there were no modes below here. So I just set my initial condition up, I don't know, here. Sorry, it's the other way. So I set my initial condition up here so that I can just have a causal way of producing all these modes. So by measuring the correlation of density fluctuations or potential fluctuations or anything like that at different places, we can test this idea, right? And the fact that this is not zero on scales that are as big as the observable universe is a manifestation of this statement that there have to be these acausal correlations. Okay, so that has to be in there. That's like baked in. You can think of it as like conspiracies that were set up at a very early time. They just had to be there from the beginning. Right? The plot had to be set. Fate is ordained. Fate of these modes is to be correlated. So, okay, so that's the last property that we needed to discuss in order to sort of list the things that we need to explain, that any theory of initial conditions for lambda CDM needs to explain. Okay, so we wrote a lot of them down last time, so I'll just recap what those were. So the first one, we needed an expanding universe. Second one, we needed the right ingredients around. So how do we explain the numbers that we need to put in to get what the homogeneous Robertson-Walker universe looks like? Part of those ingredients, which I'll separate out as a separate problem, is so why do we observe the universe to be so flat? Because if there is any curvature, that requires a big hierarchy between the radius of curvature and the horizon. Why is it that if we look at the scale factor today divided by the scale factor at some initial time, this is so big? Like, why do we have such a big old universe? Because if we think about the energy scales that go into all the physics that we know and love, the time today is way bigger than an inverse EV. It's way bigger than an inverse MEV. It's way bigger than an inverse GEV. It's way bigger than an inverse Planck mass, and so on and so forth. There are all these fundamental scales, and it seems like our universe is just way older than the time scale set by any of those fundamental scales. Why is that? why are the density fluctuations set at some initial time so tiny? Why are those fluctuations Gaussian? Why are those fluctuations nearly scale invariant? So there was this parameter. If ns was equal to 1, it was perfectly scale invariant. But in our universe, it's 0.96. So kind of a follow-up is, why is it like not exactly scale invariant, but just almost scale invariant to within 4%. why are the density fluctuations adiabatic? You can also view that as a conspiracy, right? So it's like the universe conspired that it will never have any places in it where the density of one thing is compensated by the density of the other. So whenever there is more matter, there's always more photons. There's no compensation. And that, again, requires some correlations. So speaking of those correlations, we need these super horizon correlations. That's an input. Let's see where I am, 10. Something we haven't really talked about, but we will talk about eventually, is that the universe is inhomogeneous in the distribution of matter and not full of gravitational waves, right? There are different ways we can make the universe inhomogeneous. One is to put different distributions of matter. And another way to do it would be to just put a bunch of ripples in space-time, call those gravitational waves. Okay? Seems like our universe is full of mostly fluctuations in matter and not really of gravitational waves. But why is that? All right, so there's at least 10 things, and there's probably more that we could list, that any theory of initial conditions for lambda CDM needs to explain in order for us to have such a great theory of the late universe. So here's the solution in a picture. That's not at all the picture I want to draw. Let's draw this one first. Okay, so at late times, we have this growing co-moving horizon corresponding to radiation domination and so on and so forth. And if at some point we could make the co-moving horizon do this, then if we traced any scale we like, let's say this one, if we go back early enough, we could make it sub-horizon, and therefore we could have a causal way of setting up these fluctuations. And as long as the universe had this phase of a decreasing co-moving horizon for long enough, then we could explain all of the observed scales. So there will be a largest scale. Set by the size of the observable universe, right? So as long as this phase lasts long enough to encompass all of those scales, we're good. Now, as it turns out, some kind of neat thing happens in lambda CDM, which is that once the cosmological constant comes to dominate, it actually turns the ship around and causes the co-moving horizon to come down at late times. And so there is literally a largest scale that is ever sub-horizon. Okay, so with that, we can sort of check off this guy. It helps us check off this guy because the coordination of different types of stuff. Well, if it had the same causal origin, then that's probably okay too. It can help us with this, right? Why is the universe so big and old? Okay, and more or less, it's so big and old because we can populate it with all possible co-moving scales. Okay, so in principle, it can get big and old. Why is the curvature so small? Well, if we postulate that whatever the physics is that is responsible for making the co-moving horizon get small, we could have curvature be important before that era. Okay, and what would happen is that there would be a scale associated with curvature that's a constant co-moving scale. Okay, and if that scale is set by the beginning of this era, then that can be way bigger than the observable universe, and hence we observe a really small curvature. So that can happen. There's some unspecified physics here that takes us from this regime in the early universe to what happens afterwards. And in principle, that can help us explain these things here, so what the ingredients are. Well, if they're set by whatever happens at the end of this postulated era, and also if the universe is expanding here, if A dot is bigger than zero, well, if A dot was always bigger than zero, then it just will stay bigger than zero. Okay. And so the basic requirement for ticking off a lot of these boxes, and I would argue that the most important box to tick off is the one that has to do with the acausal correlations. Basically, all we need to do is that. Okay, so what does that? Maybe before we do that, let's draw these other pictures, and let's just hammer home this point that this is really what we need. So if we draw a picture of tau versus x now, we have the co-moving horizon during radiation domination that grew like tau. Okay. Okay, there's some transition period where that's the bottom of the curve up there. We don't know what happens. And then we have H inverse coming in, getting smaller, right? So now if we consider some object of fixed co-moving size, like we did before, we can see that as long as that object was constructed down here, it was no problem to do that causally, right? All these little robots could come in from infinity, build this thing, and then it goes on, right? So the acausality is kind of an illusion. It's only because we neglected the bottom part of this picture. So that's another way of understanding this, the same thing. Okay, if we were to draw that picture up there with the light cones, then the way that we solve problems is we had these two points. Which we said were not correlated. But now, if we're allowed to follow them backwards in time for far enough, then they can come from some common origin, right? So the conditions here can now influence the properties of these points that are seemingly acausally related. So we solve the problem by saying that tau equals zero, or tau close to zero, is not really the beginning of time, but there was something that happened before that. Yet another way of saying all this. Okay, so when you read papers, especially if you read papers as a function of time, you read old papers, you read new papers, people call the Big Bang different things. So oftentimes, it is this beginning of radiation domination that is called the Big Bang. And then you read a paper and it says inflation happened before the Big Bang. You're like, what? I thought the Big Bang was the curvature singularity and nothing happened before that. So that's what they mean when you read that. Inflation itself, though, we don't think, or some other period of the early universe, does not necessarily that epoch itself might have started with a singularity, which is also sometimes called the Big Bang. So the Big Bang either means, depending on the context, this time or this time. So just be careful, because you'll see people talk about it and read about it in different contexts, and they might mean the beginning of the radiation-dominated era, or they might really mean like the beginning of time. Depends on the context. Okay. So how do we do this? Okay, so that's 1 over A times H, okay? So there's sort of two extremes that you can imagine. Let's make the Hubble parameter roughly constant and make A get really big, so A grow with time. Well, that'll do the trick. 1 over A is getting bigger. And that can make the co-moving horizon shrink. That's inflation, okay? So if I had a scale factor that was e to the ht, where h is a constant, then h inverse goes like 1 over h e to the minus ht. And if we wrote this in terms of the appropriate conformal time, it's actually minus tau. So something that looks like a De Sitter universe, where H is constant and A grows, can give me a decreasing co-moving horizon. That's not the only way to do it. So you can imagine another way to do it would be the opposite extreme. So you could say that the scale factor remains roughly constant and H grows a lot. That's what happens in the so-called ekparadic universe. Okay? You find some reason that A can be constant in the Hubble parameter, the density grows drastically. And in principle, that can cause the co-moving horizon to decrease. Well, those are two extremes. And so if you want to invent your own theory of the early universe, you could find something in between those two extremes. And that's a game that sometimes people play. Question?
H depends on A, right? So it's, I mean, A is considered as time. How do you really make H grow the way you want the A or the T to be big compared to what?
Well, so H depends on some power of A. So I can make A not change by a lot, but H change by a whole lot if I make that power really enormous. That's more or less the same. Yeah, and then, you know, the stuff in between. So like another example would be a universe where the scale factor is decreasing. Okay, the universe is crunching, and so H is getting big. And as long as H gets bigger faster than A gets smaller, then 1 over AH can get small. Okay, that's the bouncing universe scenario. And then what is it called? Anyway, there are variations on the theme. But the important part is that you make that decrease, okay? Over a long enough time, over a large enough region of scales. So we're going to focus on one particular solution, which is inflation. There's a great reason for that, by the way. I don't knock experimentation with new theoretical ideas. And I definitely encourage new theoretical ideas. But there are some distinct advantages of this solution, for example, over this one. Because somehow, in this one, if we make a plot of H versus time, it needs to do some funny business. And in general, to make that happen is really hard and requires you to invent some stuff that does not like the standard energy conditions. And so you can do it. There are some theoretical games to play, but it's hard. So we're going to do this one, which doesn't require me to do anything hard. So inflation is kind of this general. When I say inflation, I just mean a way of making the co-moving horizon decrease by saying that H is approximately constant and the scale factor grows. So it's not really a theory. It's an idea. Yeah, it's just a general vague idea of what I need to do to solve some of these initial conditions problems with lambda CDM. So let's try and define it. So we need three ingredients. So we need this homogeneous, nearly De Sitter phase to solve this problem of causality. We need a transition to radiation domination. Okay, we need that to answer the ingredients question why the universe is growing, and you know, well, basically those questions. So how do we end up with the universe full of matter and radiation after this? That's usually called, so this is called inflation. That's called reheating. Let me actually call this inflationary cosmology. And the third ingredient we need is some mechanism to produce the perturbations. We'll talk about these two today, and then number three, you're gonna have to wait until part two. Okay, so the claim is that we can use known physics to build models that can accomplish these three goals. Okay. And one of the most useful ingredients in all of cosmology and maybe in all of physics are scalar fields. Okay. So we need to invent some stuff that we can fill the universe with that can do these jobs. And that magical stuff is the scalar field. So the Lagrangian density that we're going to consider is the following. So we've got some particle phi. That particle is characteristically called the inflaton, okay? And it has some canonically normalized kinetic term, so that's got all the time and space derivatives, and then there's some potential. Okay, just so an aside on units, the action is the integral over all space and all time of the Lagrangian density. And in our units where h bar and c are one, the action is dimensionless, okay? Position has units of 1/(mass^4), and so that implies that the Lagrangian has to have units of mass^4, right? So if we go into the Lagrangian density, here we've got derivative of phi squared. Derivative has power 1/(mass), and therefore phi has to have powers of mass. So our field phi has units of mass. Okay, so from the action, we can derive the energy momentum tensor. We get that by varying the action with respect to the metric. I guess with respect to the inverse metric, if we want to write it lower. Okay, so if we expand this out, we get something for a general space-time. We can write down the thing we're most interested in, which is for FRW, and I'll just tell you the answer. So there's the time-time component. If you turn the crank, you get the following. So that's the time-time component. And then we'll get a component should have written it down here. Let me just transcribe it. Okay, and then there's a space-space component. There's a diagonal piece. And then in general, there's an off-diagonal piece too. That looks something like this, okay? A bit of notation or nomenclature. So the dot is the time derivative. We usually call this term the kinetic energy of the field. That's a spatial gradient squared. We usually call that the gradient energy of the field. And that V is the potential, so we usually call that the potential energy of the field. So if we have a homogeneous configuration of the scalar, which you can imagine would be sort of the appropriate assumption to make if I had a homogeneous background. So if we have a homogeneous configuration, that means that all the derivatives of phi are zero. Then the TT component looks like kinetic energy plus potential energy. And the IJ component now looks like kinetic energy minus potential energy. Okay. And it's diagonal. And if we were to remember the energy momentum tensor for a perfect fluid, the TT component was just minus the density, and the IJ component was the pressure. Okay. So to this scalar configuration, this homogeneous scalar configuration, we can see that it behaves kind of like a perfect fluid, or it looks kind of like a perfect fluid at the level of the energy momentum tensor, with some density and some pressure. Okay. And there are two extremes to consider. So if the field was dominated by the kinetic energy, then you can see that rho is phi dot squared over 2, and p is phi dot squared over 2. So rho, p equals rho. And so remember the proportionality constant between p and rho for a perfect fluid is the equation of state parameter, w. So in this regime, we get w is plus 1. In the opposite regime, where the potential energy is way more important than the kinetic energy, then p equals minus rho, w equals minus 1. So one of the reasons that scalar fields are the most useful thing in cosmology is that I can use them to make a fluid that has all possible equations of state that are consistent with the dominant null and null energy conditions. So the energy conditions that told you that fluctuations propagate slower than the speed of light. So that is super duper useful, and that's why you see scalar fields in operation during inflation, at late times, you know, as interesting particle physics models that could explain dark matter and so on and so forth. They just have a huge amount of versatility in what they can do in cosmology. But in particular, this one is interesting. Yeah, question?
Yeah. It can reproduce radiation.
Yeah, no, you can.
There is no way you have.
Yep.
So.
No, I can. So if I take a scalar field and I give it some potential, little aside. You'll do this in your tutorial, by the way, so you can show yourself later. Okay, so if we took some potential and we considered a configuration, an initial condition, where the scalar field is just oscillating harmonically around some minimum, and I find the time averaged row and the time averaged pressure, then I can make the time averaged pressure equal 1/3 the time averaged row. And all that is required is a potential V where phi is some power. And at some point I could probably have told you what power that was, but I don't remember off the top of my head right now. It's got to be power less than 2. No, greater than 2. Yeah, this one got to be greater than 2. But anyway, yes, you can do that. I challenge you to say something that a scalar field cannot do. Which is super frustrating, because that's why it's so hard to come up with new models of the early universe, because it all ends up just being a freaking scalar field that does anything you want. okay. Anyway, believe me and like come see me if you want me to show you on the board. We'll do it together. Okay, so at least we can make these two extremes happen in these limits. We're interested in this one, okay? Because if you recall, for W equals minus 1, for a fluid where pressure is equal to minus the density, this is de Sitter, right? So this gives me a scale factor that goes like e to the ht, which we said was exactly the thing we needed to solve this issue with causality. Okay. So, of course, the field is a dynamical thing, right? So we need to find solutions. We need to make sure there are actually solutions where P can equal minus rho for some extended period of time. We can always make this happen instantaneously, just by fiat, but then things will evolve and it might evolve away from an equation of state of W equals minus 1. Furthermore, we know that that can't last forever because we don't live in a universe that's still inflating. So eventually inflation has to end. And so we need W to be minus 1 for a while, and then it needs to transition to radiation domination somehow. So it can't last forever. So we need the dynamics. One way to get the dynamics to get the equation of motion would be to find the covariant derivative of the stress tensor, just like we do for anything else. Another way would be to vary the action with respect to the fields, in which case we just get the Euler-Lagrange equation for fields. Covariant derivative is important here because even if at the level of the Lagrangian up there, so at the level of the Lagrangian, you said that these were partial derivatives, and let's just write it here. But the partial derivative of a scalar is just equal to the covariant derivative of a scalar. But what is not true is that the second partial derivative of a scalar is equal to the second covariant derivative of a scalar. Okay. Equations of motion tend to be second order, so that's important because here I've got two derivatives. Okay. So it's important that it's a covariant derivative and not a partial derivative. If we were doing special relativity, then this would be, it wouldn't matter. Partial derivatives are fine. Okay, so, right? Okay, that's what we get from evaluating the Euler-Lagrange equation. dV d phi, we're going to be lazy and call v prime. And then we can specialize to a Robertson-Walker universe. So if we specialize to an FRW universe, and we specialize to a homogeneous field, so we neglect all of the spatial derivatives of phi, then we end up with the following equation of motion for phi. Okay, so that's the equation of motion for phi. We have the energy momentum tensor here. We said it looks just like a perfect fluid. And so we know what Einstein's equations are going to give us. They're just going to give us the Friedmann equation again. So the equation that will tell us how the scale factor evolves is just that, 8 pi g over 3 rho, if we forget about curvature for a minute. Now, g, Newton's constant, we can write in the units where we're using, where h bar and c are 1, in terms of the Planck mass. And I gave you a stern warning at some point, I think it was in the first lecture, about different definitions of the Planck mass. And now it's going to start to matter which one I use. So we're going to define a Planck mass as 1 over g, 1 over the square root of g. And rho phi was just phi dot squared over 2 plus v of phi. So the Friedmann equation and the field equation here are going to fully determine the dynamics. So this will tell us about how phi evolves with time, and this will tell us how the scale factor evolves in time. Okay, and that's all we need. We can solve anything we want now. Okay, so now let's discuss solutions that do what we want. Namely, they give us w equals minus 1 for a while, and then they stop giving us that. So inflation ends. Okay, so we need the potential energy to dominate the kinetic energy. The first model of inflation that tried to do this was the following. We imagine that the universe can have two phases, one where there's some local minimum of the potential. So here we just have some constant potential energy. And if the field is stationary, the kinetic energy is exactly zero. Okay. Classically, the field would just sit here forever. We'd have inflation happening forever. Okay. Clearly, that's not what we want. Okay. We want inflation to end. And so in this model, you rely on a quantum mechanical phenomenon where the field wants to tunnel through this barrier. This happens inside of bubbles. And those bubbles form, and then inside the bubbles, inflation can end. So it's kind of like a first order phase transition from water to steam, for example. Now, this idea failed because it turns out that it's really hard to make inflation end this way because the time it takes for you to tunnel out is exponentially long. It's quantum mechanics, right? So if you think about tunneling through a barrier, the decay time is typically exponential, right? And that's too long. So in this model, inflation never ends. That's called old inflation. And that's Guth in 1980. If you stick around until Tuesday, you'll learn about your assignment to read a classical paper. And one of those classical papers that you could pick is this paper, which is an excellent paper. OK, so this doesn't work, although this idea comes back in the late 90s, early 2000s, and people got really interested in this for different reasons, because string theory predicts there are many such different vacua, like 10 to the 500 of them or more, or an infinite number, who knows. And therefore, generically, we should expect that this might have happened in the early universe, and maybe we are living inside of one of these bubbles. And I love this idea. I worked on this idea a lot. I would love to tell you about this idea, but we're not going to do it. Okay. So that idea kind of doesn't work. And so a few years later, Andre Linde came along and suggested the following. So if instead of looking for these critical points in a potential where you can make the kinetic energy exactly zero, let's go back to this equation and notice that this looks like a simple harmonic oscillator, right? If V was approximately quadratic, plus a damping term. And if we just recall our freshman physics class, we know there are different solutions for the damped harmonic oscillator. One of them looks like the oscillator slowly decreasing. That's the overdamped solution, okay? Where the friction term dominates the acceleration. Okay, so the idea is to look for these overdamped solutions, okay? This is where the acceleration is far smaller than the damping. So if we could find such solutions, I think I got a minus sign wrong somewhere, didn't I? Be a minus here. Sorry about that. Okay, so there should be solutions where the acceleration dominates, and then you have this slow overdamped motion. Okay, so we'd like this to be true. If we're going to get an exponentially or almost exponentially expanding universe from this, we need another condition, which is that the potential energy has also got to dominate over the kinetic energy, right? Okay. So we want overdamped motion, because that means the field can like stick around a certain place for a while. And then we want potential energy to dominate so that we can get W equals approximately minus 1. All right, so we have these two conditions. So let's work out how to arrange them. So let's look at the second one first. So we would like for the potential energy to be bigger than the kinetic energy. So we want this to be much bigger than 1. Okay, so phi dot, if we assume we have what we're looking for, which is this overdamped solution, we know how to relate that to the derivative of the potential. So that is V prime over 3h squared, right? Square of phi dot. And then let's divide that by 2 times the potential. Okay, so okay, we get a V prime squared. We get a 9 times 2, 18. We get a h squared, and then we have v. So H squared is just if potential energy is dominating, proportional to V. So we've got an 8 pi over 3 m Planck squared times V. Okay? And then we get another power of V, so times V squared. Okay, and then cancel a few factors out. And the kinetic energy will be much smaller than the potential energy as long as the first derivative of the potential divided by the potential squared is way less than 1 over m Planck squared, basically. Right? So this combination is much less than 1. Okay, so we need a flat potential. Relative to the height. Okay, so then there's the other condition. We also need that phi double dot has got to be much less than 3h phi dot. So we could work out what's necessary for that. Okay, so phi double dot, that's d phi dot dt. If we really have the overdamped solution, that's d dt of minus v prime over 3h. Yeah. So we could take the derivative of the h. We'll get a h dot v prime over 3h squared. And then we can turn that time derivative into a phi derivative by adding a phi dot. So then we get d phi dt dv prime d phi times the 1 over 3h. Okay, and we can combine those things together. We'll get h dot v prime over 3h squared and then minus phi dot over 3h v double prime. Okay, so that's how we can rewrite phi double dot. And now we can compare that to 3h phi dot. We really just need the absolute magnitude of this to be small. So phi dot or phi double dot could take different signs, but let's not worry about that subtlety. So we've got h dot v prime over 3h squared minus phi dot over 3h v double prime divided by 3h phi dot. Okay, so if we focus on the different terms, so we've got the second term here, the phi dots will cancel and we get an h squared. So this piece is going to look like v double prime over v. Here we've got an h dot. We could turn that into a d d phi by adding a phi dot and then turn this into v prime squared. And so if you chug through it, you'll find that this first piece is basically what we calculated over here. That's got to be way less than 1. And then we get another piece here, which is m Planck squared over 8 pi v double prime over v. And that's got to be way less than 1. We've already argued that this should be way less than 1, so we need this other piece to be way less than 1, too. So the curvature of the potential has to be small. Relative to the height again. Okay. So we need a flat potential that is not too curved. And then in principle, we can use those two conditions to construct this overdamped solution where the potential energy dominates the kinetic energy. Okay, these are typically conditions are changed ever so slightly. So we define two slow roll conditions that are related to these two conditions, that kinetic energy is subdominant and that the acceleration is subdominant. Okay, so this one is the same as this one up to a factor of 3. It's just the convention. Why is that the convention? Because we can relate epsilon to minus the time derivative of the Hubble constant over the Hubble constant squared if we do this. And that we can rewrite as minus d log h d n e, where we define n e, I'll just do it down here actually, as hdt, okay? So this is like the thing that appears in the exponent if you have de Sitter. So it's counting how many powers of e does the scale factor change. Okay. So that's a definition. And so we can rephrase this condition that the potential is flat as the condition that the Hubble parameter does not change too much over every E folding time. Okay? So I have an approximately constant Hubble. That's kind of what we need. Okay, so that's the one condition. The other condition is that we have the second derivative small of the potential. Okay. And this is just telling us about how fast the first condition changes over every E fold. So how fast is epsilon changing? Okay. Does that remain approximately constant over every E fold? So if I have some scalar field potential, then I can just plug in the form of that potential to these equations and figure out if slow roll inflation can happen or not, if I can find these overdamped solutions or not. And there's a few kind of like schematic pictorial ways of getting that. So one way of doing that would be potential that is like a power law. So like a canonical example would be 1/2 m squared phi squared. So if I go up high enough on the potential, as we go up, Hubble goes up. Hubble was the thing that controlled the amount of friction. Right? And so we get more and more friction as we go further up the potential. And because it's a power law and I take one derivative, the potential gradient is growing slower than the friction. a little bit. So as long as I go up high enough, eventually the friction will dominate, and I will get this slow roll solution. So that's one way of doing it. We could work it out real quick. So let's say V is lambda phi to the n. So epsilon is 1 over 16 pi m Planck squared. V prime gives me a n lambda phi to the n minus 1. And then I've got a lambda phi to the n, right? So so here we get a, and that's squared, n squared divided by phi squared. So as long as I make phi really big compared to m Planck, I can make epsilon small. And the eta is almost the same, right? Same condition. I take two derivatives, I get a 1 over phi squared with a different coefficient. So for this type of model, inflation occurs at values of phi that are big compared to the m Planck. Turns out that's so you could say, oh, but nothing is supposed to be bigger than m Planck, because otherwise you need to worry about quantum gravity. And the answer here is that it's not the field value that matters necessarily, but the value of the potential. So as long as lambda is small, then V is always less than lambda to the fourth power. Or V is always less than m Planck to the fourth power. No problem with quantum gravity. Okay, so that's one way. Another way of making inflation happen would be in a potential that looks something like this. So if I have an inflection point, as long as I'm really close to that inflection point, then the slow roll parameters are really tiny. Okay, and we can make inflation happen. Now, for these types of potentials, that condition only is satisfied at a point. And so if I stray away from that point, then quickly the slow roll parameters will stop being small. Okay? And so typically here, if we look at this distance between where inflation happens and where we are today, is smaller than m Planck. And then the other thing you could do is imagine, well, I want to make epsilon small. And that can happen in the vicinity of a local maximum, because V prime is small. And as long as the curvature of that local maximum is small, then I can make the slow roll parameter small. To make that happen, it turns out phi s sort of be of order m Planck, not too much bigger, not too much smaller. Okay, so you can write down all these potentials. You could figure out if epsilon and eta are small and where they're small. But how do we decide if you have a successful model, right? So what's a good model of inflation? So we need to estimate the number of e-folds. That's basically by how much did the universe expand, right, from the beginning of inflation to the end. And that's going to tell us about how much the co-moving horizon shrunk. We needed to shrink by at least the amount that the universe grew, right? So what we need is that if we compare the co-moving Hubble when the universe, when inflation began, it has to be at least equal to the co-moving Hubble today. And that's going to require the scale factor to have changed by a certain amount. that translates into the number of e-folds being of order 60. And that's something you work out in one of your homework problems, exactly what that number is. Okay, so we can estimate this given a potential. So we just look at the definition. Okay, so the number of e-folds was just defined as this integral over h. Okay, but h is related to v, and we can trade t for a phi dot. So we can write this as an integral over phi. And then you can play around with the solution. We know what phi dot is in terms of v prime. V prime is related to epsilon. And then after the dust settles, you get the following. Where we define the end of inflation as the field value where the slow roll parameter is 1. OK, so given a potential, we can get epsilon as a function of phi, and we can calculate the number of e-folds as a function of where we start on the inflaton potential. So practically speaking, that's what you do. You sit down with some model of inflation described by some potential. You figure out where the slow roll parameters are small. And then you ask, do they remain small enough over a wide enough range that the number of e-folds can at least be 60, in which case you can solve this horizon problem. You can get the co-moving Hubble to shrink as much as it grows later. At this level, you'd say, yay, I've got a model of inflation that can at least solve some of the problems of lambda CDM, namely this causality problem. But there's more, right? So so inflation ends, and then what, right? So to pick on an example, let's look at this model. So let's say epsilon is small in this range. So the field undergoes this overdamped motion. And then eventually, the gradient of the potential overcomes that. The kinetic energy starts to get big. And then it comes down the potential, and it oscillates around the bottom. And if the universe was just full of the inflaton field, and that's it, then it would just oscillate around the bottom forever. You'll show in your tutorial that would cause the universe to expand like a matter-dominated universe, and then that would be the end of things. That would just be the history of the universe. So we need something to happen here. We need some way of dumping the energy of the inflaton into radiation. And the way to do that is to couple it to some other particles, preferably particles that also talk to the standard model so that we could end up with standard model particles, right? Eventually, what happens is phi is going to decay into standard model particles in a process called reheating. That will be the focus of one of your tutorial questions. So I will leave it to that. Okay. So another measure of success for any inflaton model is, do you reheat the universe to a hot enough temperature that BBN can happen, or you can have some solution for the matter-antimatter asymmetry, and so on and so forth. Okay. And then finally, there's all the stuff about the fluctuations. And we'll cover that in detail later. But more or less, you can get most of the properties that we have on the board here about the fluctuations almost for free from inflation. So Gaussian fluctuations follow from the fact that the inflaton field doesn't really have many self interactions, or they're not that important, because otherwise you'd actually ruin these slow roll conditions. The fact that you get adiabatic fluctuations is coming from this. So the inflaton decays into some mixture of radiation and other particles, and it does that the same way everywhere. So there's a synchronization of the mixture. You get the scale invariant piece from the smallness of the slow roll parameters. Okay, so that's going to be the thing that sets what scales are. How is the horizon behaving in time? And it turns out if the horizon shrinks at approximately the same rate over most times, then you get a nearly scale invariant spectrum of fluctuations. And you get a small amplitude set of fluctuations due to the fact that the energy densities are quite small compared to M. Planck. And you're really creating particles through the expansion of the universe. Okay, so you might have heard about Hawking radiation. It's the equivalent of Hawking radiation in an expanding universe, and that's kind of controlled by G Newton. So this hierarchy between the scale of inflation and G Newton tells you that the amplitude of fluctuations are small. And it turns out that that hierarchy also tells you why the universe is full of matter fluctuations and not gravitational wave fluctuations. So there's kind of a beautiful story of how all that comes together, that these basic requirements that you need to guarantee causality kind of give you for free most of the properties of the fluctuations. So if you read a historical book or popular book, it's always about this stuff, like how do you solve the horizon problem or the flatness problem. But we understand so much more about the universe now that it's like really amazing. In fact, I'd say that this idea can encompass all of these different conditions. And so that's what we'll talk about later. All right, so sorry I went over, but I wanted to finish. So that's all I have to say for part one. You can take a little break, go to your tutorial, and yeah, I hope to see you on Tuesday.